What's up, everyone, and welcome to the ninth episode of Shooting the Breeze. I'm your host, Max Hooper, and the purpose of this podcast is for me to share my unique basketball experiences and perspectives while also sharing those of my guests. For those of you who aren't aware, my entire senior season at Oakland University, I did not attempt one two-point field goal, and I took a whole lot of threes, 257 of them, as a matter of fact. I have always prided myself in being a great shooter, and that is what continues to propel my basketball career. So, yep, you guessed it. On this show, we'll be talking shooting. Today, I have a very special guest. He is currently the Director of Scouting and Recruiting Innovations at Oakland University. That's Alex Varlin. I first met Alex when I arrived at Oakland University in 2014, prior to my junior year. That was when he first began working at, his first year at Oakland as well. Prior to Oakland, he worked at Tennessee on the women's side of things under Pat Summitt for 4 years as a student manager. And after that, he spent a year working for the Philadelphia 76ers in the front office. He's a guy, he may not get a lot of credit for the work he does, but it helps the players and coaching staff a whole lot. He and I started a routine my senior year with my roommate, Martez Walker, where the day of the game in the hotel, he would bring both me and Martez about 8 to 10 clips of ourselves from the last game on his laptop. Some would be things we did well, some would be things that we can improve on. They all focused on small details and small little subtleties that Coach Campy might not have the time to address with each individual player. Alex, as they call him, AV, adds a lot of value to the Oakland University basketball program that goes unnoticed by many. Here is a chance to recognize all of the great things that he does for the program. Without any further ado, what's up, AV? Great to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me on here, Max.
Absolutely. So, you know, with no further ado, let's just dive right into it. You know what I mean?
Let's do it.
Let's get the ball rolling. And this is shooting the breeze. You know, that's the name of this podcast. So let's talk some shooting right away. If you're teaching, you know, a young player or maybe even a college player, or just observing a player, what are three major keys that you would look at in a shooter that would determine how good of a shooter they are?
Right. This is something, you know, shooting, especially with young players, teaching them what you look for, is something that we could probably talk the whole podcast about. But I'll keep it simple for us to start. The number one thing I look for is whether a guy can make shots. Because at the end of the day, everybody's shot's going to look different. And for some guys, it's just the natural movement of their elbow or their arms. They can't put it in the textbook way that you want to. So I look for guys who can make shots. I mean, look at your shot, Max. It's not necessarily the perfect form shot, but you're one of the best shooters in the world.
Sure.
But if I'm looking at it, you know, further into that, you know, I like guys, you got to hold your follow through, the simple things like that. And I'm big on feet to target. Your feet got to be facing your target. And then lastly, I'm big on letting the pointer finger be the last one to touch the ball. That's something I look for. I think that gives you the good backspin on the ball that you need to be a good shooter.
Sure. You know, people could debate those last two things probably till the cows come home. You know, everyone has, like you said, everyone has their own form. And I've talked about this on the podcast before. You know, everyone has their own signet. You know, everyone's body's different. Everyone has, like, just like in the real world, everyone has different handwriting. Everyone has, you know, a different signature. And everyone's jump shot's going to look the same. You know, not everyone is going to look like that picture perfect textbook Klay Thompson or JJ Redick shooting form. But, you know, you look at a guy like Reggie Miller, you know, I don't think you'd want to teach any kids to shoot like Reggie Miller, but you, in terms of the way it looks, but you definitely want to teach kids, you know, to put the ball in the way that Reggie Miller does. So let's roll into what I've got for us next. Let's talk about just the overall impact a shooter can have on a team. How does that impact, you know, anyone on the court, from an offensive perspective?
Right. Well, having a great shooter, like you mentioned, Reggie Miller or a JJ Redick, a guy like that on the floor, affects the whole game. All five guys on defense are always aware when a great shooter is on the floor, where he is and what he's doing. All the coaches on the bench are aware of a great shooter and what he's doing, and they're game planning to stop him, and they're worried about him. And part of that is because of the value of the three. Today, more threes are shot than ever before because teams are realizing the simplicity that three is worth more than two. And even if you're shooting 35% from three, that's better than shooting 37% from two. So you have a great shooter out there, and even if you just stick him in the corner, his man all of a sudden it has to stand right next to him. So therefore you're playing 4-on-4 with everybody else. And as anyone knows who's played basketball, it's easier to get to the basket and do what you want 4-on-4 versus 5-on-5 just because there's more space. And then you add on to it when you have someone like J.J. Redick or Kyle Korver or even Max Hooper who really knows what they're doing as a shooter, they're cutting at all times. They're always moving around the three-point arc and trying to find open areas and trying to get themselves a shot. But even more importantly, they know that them cutting is bringing the focus of the defense to them, and it's opening things up even more for every other player on the floor, like we talked about.
Yeah, those are all great points. You echoed exactly what I would have said if I was posed that question. But let's flip it a little bit and say, so how can players with certain skill sets help the shooter? I'm going to go into my vocabulary bag, in a symbiotic relationship, you know, how do they mutually benefit from each other? Just talk about how a shooter benefits from a great screening big man, maybe, or a great, a great point guard. You could even talk about it in the context of our Oakland team from last year, if you want.
Right. Well, we will do that then. Let's talk about you and Jalen Hayes, who's a four-man at Oakland University, all-conference player. Mm-hmm. And in a simple action, we'll say Jalen Hayes sets a pin-down screen for Max Hooper. Mm-hmm. There are two guys engaging in a screening action, and it sounds very simple to guard it, but when you add in a guy who's shooting 45% from three, who can catch and dribble and still shoot, who can catch and fade away, shoot it any way, it really adds a different dynamic to it. So Max comes off the screen, and the guy guarding Jalen all of a sudden has to worry about Max, so he's jumping out to make sure Max cannot catch the ball right on the three-point line. He has to help Max's man because it's called attaching to the hip pocket on the shooter, and you have to do that against the shooter, and that leaves you vulnerable to curling to the basket and different actions such as that. So the big jumps out to make Max have to go further, and that leaves a slip for the big man Jalen straight to the basket. And he's wide open, uncontested. When you have a great point guard like Kay Felder was for Oakland last year, it's an easy pass for 2 points right there. So I'd say the relationship between a shooter and a screener is very important. And the relationship between a point guard and a shooter is also important. As you and Kay would often talk about last year, you would tell Kay exactly where you want to catch the ball. Mm-hmm. When you want to catch the ball, mm-hmm. all those different types of things. So there's a special relationship between the point guard and the shooter as well.
Absolutely. And the way you talk about it, or the way I've talked about it before on this podcast, you know, I make it seem awfully simple, you know, boom, you can just screen and then one of you is going to get open. But, you know, I think that's something that takes, you know, it takes maybe even multiple seasons, but it takes time and time getting the rhythm down and getting the being on the same page with, you know, the screener, the passer, and the shooter. You know, it's not like you can just boom overnight, just say, okay, this is your job, this is your job, this is your job. So talk about the way like a coach might define roles, or just talk about roles and how important you think those are within a team's context.
Right. I think defining roles on a team may be one of the single most important jobs of a head coach. Mm-hmm. And that's because in order for everyone to succeed, they need to know your expectations for them, what you expect from them night in and night out. Now, some guys, Steph Curry, you go to him and say, I expect you to play at an MVP level. I expect you to create for yourself and also create for others. Mm-hmm. But then you bring in other guys like, we'll say, for example, a lunch pail guy like Jamichael Green, mm-hmm. we expect you to screen for the shooters. We expect you to box your guy out. We expect you to play really hard and crash the offensive boards. Mm-hmm. So when you lay out those expectations for a player, it allows him then to flourish in his role. If you just go and roll the ball out, everyone who is this successful to play Division I basketball, to play in the NBA, they're confident in their skills. And they want to go out there and show it. So if you just roll the ball out, you're going to have four or five guys trying to be the Steph Curry. But now that they know their roles, they can go out there and play freely within what you want them to do. And I get that philosophy from Brett Brown, who I worked for under with the 76ers. He's still the head coach there, and that was the very first thing he wanted to do when he got the job in Philly at the beginning of training camp. He said, I want to define the roles for everybody so they can know what they need to do to succeed.
Yeah, that's awesome. I mean, I subscribe to, you know, all that, you know what I mean? One day when I'm a head coach, that will be, you know, paramount for me, having roles defined. But I think sometimes you can, you know, set out and define roles like, you know, just boom, you're the shooter, you're this and you're that. But then also I think the nuances of the roles maybe develop organically as you gain experience and as you play with guys more and more and more, because, you know, some guys might not have a certain skill set, you know, at face value, but maybe, you realize, okay, we can use this guy in this certain way. And it's just, you know, something that develops over time. And it's tied into, like, I think team chemistry, because the team chemistry will be so great when everyone embraces their role. You know, not 10 guys are never going to score 20 points a game. You know what I mean? There's not going to be someone has to do the dirty work. Someone has to be willing to do other things. And I think you see these teams in college that tend to be, you know, senior laden, junior laden teams who have played together for multiple years, why they end up killing a lot of these teams with younger, more quote unquote talented players is they're not too proud. You know what I mean? There's certain guys, you know, they know their job is to go get buckets, but then there's other guys who aren't too proud to just say, you know what, I'm going to be committed to screening. And sure enough, though, another point is the better you screen, the more easy buckets you're going to get as a player. So I think some guys, there comes a maturity with accepting a role and realizing not every single player is going to be your Allen Iverson who fires up 30 mm-hmm. shots a night. But there are those guys, and you know, some people perceive those players as selfish or whatever, but there's guys who are, you know, either on scholarship or collecting a paycheck because their role is to go get buckets. But when you got guys working collaboratively on the same page, establishing and understanding and, you know, even going a step further and, you know, growing, you know, specifically in those roles. So it's not just Max Hooper's a shooter. It's not just Jalen Hayes is a block scorer. It's Max Hooper's a shooter who loves the ball right here so I can deliver it right there when he needs it. Jalen Hayes loves to score on a certain block and loves to go to the left-handed jump hook. How do we put him in exactly that position to be able to do that? And so we talked about it a little bit already, but just let's go a little more even in depth into the Oakland University 2015-16, my senior year. What made our offense so great? We led the nation in scoring, 86.4 points per game. I want to say we had four guys in double figures for sure. And no, we might have had five in double figures averaging. And just talk about, I mean, you had a unique insight into what made that offense so great. Just talk about what set that offense apart from a lot of other college offenses.
Right. Well, first off, we had good players. Kay Felder, Max Hooper, Jalen Hayes, Percy Gibson, Martez Walker, Sharon Dorsey Walker. The list keeps going. We had a ton of good players, and we put in an offensive system that fit our team. I think a lot of times you'll see guys that coach and they run the same system for 20 years, no matter who their personnel is. I think one of the signs of a good coach is that they're going to adapt their offense to their current players. And we did a good job with that. You know, in one way that we did is in transition, only you were allowed to shoot threes. Mm-hmm. So while we took that, we did not give that privilege to other guys. We did not take away something that was one of your strengths. You mm-hmm. shot something like 47% mm-hmm. on transition threes. And so we played an up-tempo system that put the ball in our NBA point guard's hand, mm-hmm. Kay Felder, let you run the floor and space things out, and also had two guys that could score on the block. I mean, what more can you ask for as a coach? Those are just great players. you know, just some stats to throw out at you. Against Division I teams, we shot 39.8% from the three. Mm-hmm. We only turned the ball over 15% of the time, and we shot 77% from the free throw line.
Sheesh.
Yeah, so, you know, those stats equal number one offense in the country.
Right. And, well, you know, a lot of fans, you know, might just say, oh, well, they score the most points, so they're the best, you know. But also, you know, the element of efficiency that goes into there. With those stats that you just mentioned, you know, anytime you're doing those things, and obviously we shot a high percentage overall from the field. I don't know the exact number, but, like, you know, anytime you have those numbers locked in there, then your offense is going to be efficient, and we played at a super fast pace. So if you're able to play at a super fast pace while also being efficient like that, then, I mean, you're going to have one of the best offenses in the country. You know, we're not going to talk about the other side of the ball, you know, because I'm not going to try to say we were the best team in the entire country. But just in terms of an offensive perspective, you know, we obviously did a lot of good things, and you know, it's something that coaches probably around the country should try to model their team after. If you have the appropriate personnel. So my boy AV, who's here on the show with us today, Alex Varlin, he's got a pretty unique basketball background from his experiences, from my observation. You know, he worked in college originally at Tennessee, the Volunteers, on the women's side of things as a student manager there, gathered a lot of experience from there, went on to work in the D League as a jack of all trades for both the 76ers and the D League, in the NBA and the D League for the 76ers and the 87ers, and now is in his current position at Oakland University as the director of recruiting innovations. And I think I said that right?
Director of Scouting and Recruiting Innovations. It was close.
Okay,
my bad.
You know, it's a. I don't know if there's any other director of Scouting and Recruiting Innovations ever. Has there ever been in college basketball? I don't know. He brings a lot of great things to the Oakland program from my experience. So just talk about maybe somehow can you compare and contrast, you know, those three levels, or what each experience has been like and how valuable those have been.
Right. And you really do learn a lot, not just at every level you go to, but also every different team you go to, because there's guys with different personalities. There's coaches with different systems and personalities. So you're always learning and getting better. But the number one thing that I've learned from being on the women's side, the men's side, and in the professional ranks is that if guys believe you can help them, they're going to listen to you. So if you show them you have this knowledge that you can help them get better, whether you're a 22-year-old in the NBA or a 60-year-old coach in college, they're going to pay attention and listen to everything you say. And I think another underrated aspect is that guys also want to know that you care about them as a person on and off the floor. And building that relationship with players is what then allows you to be tough on them in the hard moments when they're messing up and you see a coach screaming at a guy and you're thinking, gosh, this coach is a mean guy and whatnot. But it's not that way. This coach can be like that to a player because he has this relationship with them. He's shown he's cared, that he cares about them off the floor, and they've worked together X amount of hours, you know, 100 hours during the summer working on getting better. So when he's screaming at him, the player is just getting the message. It's a heated game and a heated moment. So the player is getting the message, but the coach can coach that player like it because he's put in the time to build a relationship with him. And I think that's a very important aspect of coaching.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, you talked about the relationship and trust. Why the hell should this college kid, or why the hell should this NBA player trust you? You know, who are you? But I think, like you said, if you present them with the knowledge that you have, and, you know, don't back down and show them that you know what the hell you're talking about. That's really what it comes down to. You know, guys, in recruiting, there's a certain process of, you know, targeting kids who are coachable and targeting kids who are willing to learn. But then also, you know, maybe there are some players who are more of a challenge, you know, who are a little more hard-headed, who think they have it all figured out. But I think those type of guys, you got to crack them by, talking with them in a calm manner, saying, hey, look, this is what I want to talk about. This is what I think you're doing wrong. This is how I think you can make yourself a much better player. And I think being able to relate to people, and like you said, having that relationship beyond basketball, I think that sometimes gets lost, it's more prevalent in college, but when you get to the next level, it's, as we know, the D League and even the NBA, it's a revolving door sometimes. And so it's hard to establish a relationship like that. And it becomes more just solely based on basketball. But talk about maybe a little bit, I don't know exactly how much you're even allowed to be involved in recruiting, but talk about, establishing, you've only been at Oakland for 3 years, but talk about establishing maybe a relationship prior to the kid coming and then carrying that into coaching the kid once he arrives.
Right, and as you hit on, in a support staff role like I'm in, I'm not as involved with directly speaking with and recruiting the kids. I'm more in the behind-the-scenes aspect of, okay, we're looking for these type of positions. Mm-hmm. Let's send guys here, here, and here because we can see as many people as possible. Mm-hmm. So for me in my role, I do not have as much of a relationship with guys coming into it.
Once the kid
right.
hits campus.
So for me, it starts once the kid hits campus, but assistant coaches and coaches, you're building relationship with guys over 3 years. You're going to see, 10 to 15 games that he's played over that time. You know his game. You know what makes him tick. You meet his family, his girlfriend, and all these people. So you really know him as an individual before he even steps on campus if you're in one of those roles.
Right, and being able to form that relationship, the better relationship you have with the kid beforehand, then that's just gonna roll right into being able to coach him hard from the get-go and get through to him and maybe hopefully you hope as a coach that you make a kid comfortable enough if he doesn't feel comfortable with something, or hey coach, I think this might work, or something like that, he feels comfortable going to you. And I mean, that's huge, so we'll talk about your future plans later on, but let's just say, put you hypothetically, college head coach right now. Just in terms of, the skill set of players and positions or any factors you want to talk about, just talk about what would be some building blocks for your ideal college team starting tomorrow.
Right. Well, first off, I want a group of guys who are not satisfied yet. Mm-hmm. Guys that come in with a chip on their shoulder. They say, I might have gotten my Division I scholarship, but I don't think I've made it. Mm-hmm. I still want to work hard and prove to all these people that I can win a national championship, that I can get to the NBA. And guys like that usually tend to be the tough guys that I define as winners. So that's the first thing I want, is to get a group of guys with that mentality. So that way I can build a culture of that. So then as I keep bringing guys in, that's what they're surrounded by when they get on campus, and they start to become like that if they're not like it already. And I think that will breed success. But secondly, and more in the skills department, I want a lot of guys who can shoot. Mm-hmm. In college basketball, it's tough because there's no defensive 3 seconds. So there's not a ton of space on the floor. It's a smaller floor anyways, mm-hmm. and a shorter 3-point line. So you need as much space as you can get in college basketball, and as many guys that you can get that are triple threats. They can dribble, they can shoot, they can pass. As many guys like that, that's what really makes a defense work. If they know you can only drive to the basket or you can only shoot, it makes you a little bit easier to guard. But if you can do all three, then you can be a real problem for the defense.
Absolutely. Yeah. If you can get 5 guys who can dribble, pass, and shoot, I think you'll win a national championship with ease. But
yeah, it's easier said than done to get that.
It's
but.
Very much easier said than done. But I think kind of what you alluded to is, a lot of people might look at, obviously a guy like me or cut out of the Travis Bader, cut from that cloth. That might be your shooter. But you can also have guys, who might only take 2 or 3 threes a game, but you can rely on them to knock it down. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Maybe as long as you're a threat.
Right. Maybe a stretch 4 or, you look at someone like Martez Walker or Sherrone Dorsey Walker, who's got a lot of other aspects to the game, but can still, knock down the shot with consistency. And even you want your point guard, not that the point guard needs to fire up, 10 threes a game, but you ideally you want your point guard to be able to knock down shots, as catch and shoot shots, once he's become a part of the offense as well. So
Yeah.
there's no ideal blueprint, and depending on what level you're at, you're only, even if you're at the highest level, you don't know which kids are going to fall into your lap and which ones are going to which ones that you might think is, oh, this kid's a perfect fit, might go elsewhere. That's kind of the wonderment of college recruiting, and like, who are you going to end up with? Who knows? But as a coach, it's so important because, you have your blueprint in your mind, maybe, or just, you have your ideologies about what a team should look like, and then you have the reality of what your team looks like, and then you as a professional, that's your job to tailor your system to fit those players into your system, but also fit the system to those players. I think there's a give and take, because you can't just no one offensive system is going to be perfect for different sets of players. You gotta change it according to who's there and what people are doing. And even from year to year, if you bring back the same team, maybe guys' skill sets expand, so you give guys more freedom, or you saw a guy who could have fit something, and you're like, well, maybe he doesn't need to be doing that. So let's take that right into, your current position now. Talk about working for my head coach, or and like our head coach, Greg Campy. Talk about what it's like to work for him and his wealth of experience. He's pretty much seen it all in college basketball. So talk about that.
That's the truth. Greg Campy definitely has seen it all. He's been at Oakland for something like 35 years now, which is he's the third longest tenured coach in Division I behind Coach K, Jim Boeheim. So if that doesn't say a lot about Coach Campy, I don't know what does. But he's really good as a young guy to work for because he lets you grow as a young coach. He gives you a long leash and lets you work with guys, and he'll sprinkle in his ideas with it, but he really gives you the leash to have your own voice and your own opinion, which I think is big for a young coach.
Definitely, definitely. I'm just thinking this now, actually, but this is I think the way he gives, like you said, he gives you freedom. I think he gives his players freedom as well, within their role. He gives if you deserve the green light, he gives you your green light, and sometimes even if you don't even if you don't deserve it, you got the green light. But I think that historically his offenses have always had extremely confident guys, whether it's been a shooter or been just an all-out scorer, those types of guys. In order to put up those types of numbers, you're gonna have to have freedom and have a coach who believes in your abilities, not necessarily just who only believes in his offense, who also believes in your abilities to be creative as a player and to figure out ways to score that no offense can draw up, that just a player can figure out and create offense. And Campy, I remember him in practice one day said, I think someone was asking, about specifically execution of how do you run this play, and he just kind of stopped practice and told us, I'd much rather have five great players than five great plays. And I think that his philosophy is, that reflects his philosophy and offense. And obviously he does. With the Oakland system, there's a lot of set calls and set plays, design plays, but there's also a lot of freedom given to certain players within that. So I think that's kind of what he was alluding to by saying that. Anything you got to add on that?
I'd say that Greg Campy allows his players to do more within his system than any other coach in college basketball. He may be the ultimate players coach. Now, usually people think of players coaches and think of guys that don't yell and are young, but Greg Campy is a players coach in a different way. Yes, he's going to be tough on you. Yes, you see the clips of him during games going crazy some of the time, but he gives his players more confidence than anyone I've ever been around. As you said, there is not a bad shot. He lets you play your game and sometimes do maybe even more than you should because he believes in his players that much.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So now we're going to go to a little slightly different angle. Talk about your role specifically with regards to the video, and talk about how important you think film is from any perspective, from a coach's perspective, from a player's perspective, and even from a young player who might have the chance to, you know, nowadays with the resources, you know, you got anyone can go on YouTube these days and just pull up clips of their, you know, their favorite player or and just study. You know, it's a lot more available than it was 10, 15 years ago. So talk about the value of that in any way that you see fit.
Right. Film might be the best teaching tool there is in basketball because in the moment in a game, you're going to grab a guy and tell him something and he could agree or disagree with it. And at the end of the day, he's going to think what he thinks because you can't show him that right in front of his face and make your point. But after the fact, you don't have the emotions of being in a game and you're sitting in front of a computer and you pull up a clip and you can really teach a guy and talk intricately about what you need him to do. So watching film is one of the most important things, and that's why I really enjoy my role at Oakland, because it's working individually with players, watching film and helping them develop as both individuals and teammates. And to build on what you're saying about young players now, high school, middle school players being able to watch film, YouTube might be the greatest tool for young players in the history of basketball, because at their fingertips, they can go watch whatever players they look up to and want to play like and watch hours of film on them, learn the footwork they need, look at their form on shooting, how hard they play defensively, everything like that. It's just great. Young guys should definitely take advantage of that.
Right. And, you know, as a young player, I think a lot of guys are like, oh, I want to play like KD. I want to play like Kyrie. I want to play like Steph Curry. But I think as, you know, a kid who's taken the time to go on YouTube to study, you know, to study, not just for the enjoyment. Let me see LeBron's dunks, you know, a kid who's taken the time to study. And, you know, there's those serious kids out there who it means something to them. And, they, you know, they have a vision for themselves. They have a vision for their future. You know, me as a young player, I think that's how I was. I would try to get my hands on his, you know, the guy I idolized was JJ Redick at Duke, you know, watching how does he come off and get himself open. You know, it's not an accident that he always gets open. And, you know, the other team is trying to stop him. Sometimes it would look like the other team wasn't even trying to stop him, but I think that was just because he was so good at getting open, you know, being deceptive. A lot of stuff that you and I have talked about, you know, just being deceptive. Showing one thing and doing something else, just faking out the defense, gaining any type of advantage that you can. And especially as a shooter, you know, all you ask for is that tiny sliver, that tiny window of breathing room to let it fly. And like you said, you talked about earlier, you know, it's so demoralizing when a guy is, the whole defense is, you know, paying attention to the shooter, tailored to take away the 3-point shot. And then, you know, you bury a shot. One of the best feelings is burying a shot and turning around and seeing the assistant coach slam his clipboard to the ground or turn around and cuss out the bench. You know, like, you guys can't find him. You know, it's just a great feeling as a shooter to you know, be able to do that to another team. And I kind of went off track there a little bit. But how, you know, just seeing how guys do that and then being able to add that into your game is huge. And I knew from a young age I wasn't going to be a LeBron. I wasn't going to be that type of player, but I knew as a shooter I could have tremendous value just by doing my job. And, you know, hopefully young players will be able to, you know, see who does what they do at the next level and, you know, maybe can aspire to that. So let's talk about this year's Oakland team a little bit. Let's talk about how, you know, the season has gone to this point and, you know, there's been a little bit of a dip, obviously, but this Oakland team brings a whole different flavor to the game than compared to last year's team, don't you think?
Without a doubt, this is a very different Oakland team. If you've been a fan of the Oakland program for any sort of time, this is more of a gritty, defensive team that wins on that end versus your all's team last year, which was about going up and down and outscoring the opponent. We've had a pretty good year, a great start to the year, beating Georgia at home, going to Valparaiso and winning. And we've hit a little bit of a rough spell that's expected when you get into the grind of conference play. We've currently lost 3 of 4, but we have a chance to get back on the horse on Friday against the good Green Bay team, and then again on Sunday against a growing Milwaukee team.
Gotcha. Yeah, I think it's just interesting, you know, because Coach Campy's been coaching at Oakland, like you said, for so many years, and you know, last year he has this knockout offensive, you know, offensive juggernaut, and this year, you know, he, you know, going into the year, you're not sure exactly how the team's going to be offensively, but you know, you employ a similar system, tailor it maybe a little bit to the guys this year, but employ a similar system. And you know, it's just so interesting how there's such different results, you know, with such different players. And I mean, I think that as a coach, that's what makes this game interesting. You know, it's no two seasons are the same, no two, you know, games are the same. You gotta keep adapting and keep being able to figure out what works in your estimation, and pretty much put your team in the best position to do, to be successful and to win, because that's your job. So talk about what's your future in this game. You know, obviously you're extremely passionate about basketball and love the coaching side of things, but you know, where do you see yourself in the short term, and ultimately maybe in the long term future?
In a perfect world, when I retire, I'll be able to say that I was a college head coach and an NBA GM. Now, there's probably a list of 5 to 6 guys, even if that, who have ever been able to do that in a lifetime. So those are lofty goals. So if I'm fortunate to do one of them, I'll feel blessed for that opportunity. Mm-hmm. I think that my next job, whether it'll be in college or in the NBA, will begin to define my path of whether I'll end up going for the college head coach or an NBA, a high-ranking NBA front office position. Mm-hmm. I'm passionate about both of them. I think they're both different but similar at the same time. But if you love basketball, either of those opportunities are ones that you'll take all day.
All right. Absolutely. Yeah. You know, with there's just totally different things. You know, obviously it's a whole nother level with the NBA, but there's just totally different things that those two perspectives have to offer. Because, you know, in college, you are a GM of sorts, you know what I mean? Because you do get to have input in, you know, to which players you acquire and who you recruit, who you target. But, you know, maybe at the, you know, any professional level, D-League, NBA, or otherwise, you know, if you're the coach, your job is coach the team. Coach the team to your best of your abilities. And, you know, in some situations, you might have a little bit of say in the type of players you get. But, you know, most situations, it's, you're handed the players you got, you're dealt the card you got, and you got to figure out the best way to play it. So although, you know, like you said, if you're passionate about it, you know, basketball has something to offer, but those are two totally different paths that maybe, you know, maybe the casual fan might not recognize those huge differences.
Yeah, without a doubt, the casual fan will always see the head coach and see them on the floor coaching and know what he does to a certain extent, still not fully in the everyday grind of the job. But no one really sees what happens in the front office. It's more closed door, behind the scene things that you really have to be in it to begin to understand all that's going on.
Right. So you talked about earlier, I put you on, you know, put you on the spot and said, if hypothetically you were a college coach, what characteristics would you look for? And you said, you know, guys who have multiple skills, able to pass, shoot, and dribble, and then have that streak, that competitive fire, that winner's mentality, whatever you want to call it, guys like that. So how, you know, I got to ask you this question: how would 3-point shooting specifically fit into your scheme? Like, how much value would you place on that?
I place a high amount of value. As we talked about during this podcast, the three is extremely important just because of the value of a shot from three, and also the spacing that it provides for guys to help guys get to the basket. So I definitely put a premium on shooting, and I think it's getting tougher and tougher to put guys on your team who are non threats from the 3-point line. Now, if you're a post player, if you play the 4 or 5, then no, I don't think you have to be able to knock down a 3. It definitely helps if you play the 4. But for the 1 through 3, I'd definitely put a premium on guys that can knock down at least an open jumper. But I'd like guys who can do more than that, who I can run off of screens and rely on them to make tough shots for me.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, obviously I'm biased, but you know, the 3-point shot, like you said, it's, you know, 3 is greater than 2. And just, you know, as people, you know, a lot of people shy away from these quote unquote analytics and, you know, the analytics movement, whatever you want to say. A lot of people shy away from those sorts of things. But for me, it's just facts. There's facts that certain types of shots, you know, statistically, the data has been mined through, you know, a corner three, and I'm going to go through the NBA lens. The corner three, you know, other than an open layup, is the highest yielding points per shot. And some, you know, basketball purists or traditionalists, you know, will shy away from, oh, I don't need to know about those numbers. But I mean, if you stretch if you emphasize corner threes and favor corner threes, you know, if you stretch those numbers out over the course of a season, given the correct personnel, you know, you can't just have your center shooting corner threes and expect to have a great offense. But, you know, if you consistently have methods of getting to the rim, getting corner threes and getting free throws, your team is going to be able to produce points at a rate that would allow you to win. Obviously, it's not as cut and dry as that because, you know, the defense in the NBA, they're under contract. You know, they're making a lot of money and they're getting paid to stop you from doing those things. So that's where it comes down to just who can execute and then who has the talent to do those sorts of things. Because it's not just like you can just say, well, we want free throws, we want corner threes, and we want layups. It's not quite that easy. You know, you got to have someone who can get those shots and make those shots. And then you see, I'll talk a little specific examples. You know, teams that embody those two things, I think, are Golden State and Houston, who do it in totally different ways. With Golden State being, you know, just all around, you know, talent across the board, guys who can make shots from anywhere, get to the rim at will. But then Houston is one that I wanted to focus on a little bit, just the way that, you know, Harden is so multi-skilled and can just get in the lane and drive and kick, finish himself, shoot the three himself, as well as, you know, at sometimes 4 shooters around the perimeter. I think that's a scary thought, you know what I mean? 4 shooters just stationed around the perimeter with a guy who can pound the lane with, you know, reckless abandon. Not something you might see in college, but at the NBA level, it's a fun thing to watch. It's definitely a fun thing to watch. Talk about if you would ever, you know, as a head coach one day, you know, maybe experiment with something, a lineup of that sort, you know, with the stretch 4 playing the 5 and all guards just, you know, get to the rim or kick it.
Yeah, it's definitely something I would consider. I think Mike D'Antoni is a great coach, and Daryl Morey, their GM, has done an exceptional job of finding players that fit his system perfectly. Mm-hmm. And I think in the NBA, just to go off topic for a second, it's really important to have a GM and a head coach that are on the same wavelength. Now, the GM, although he does hire the head coach, they don't always align as perfectly as those two are. So I think that's really a match made in heaven. And you're seeing that has breeded results for Houston this year. And I think they'll continue to win games and have a chance to make some noise come playoff time. Now, when it comes to whether I'd experiment with my roster and my style of play like Mike D'Antoni does, is something I think you definitely have to consider if you have the right personnel. I mean, how hard is it to guard when there's no one inside the 3-point line and then you have a great playmaker with the ball on the perimeter, a guy who can get to the hoop and pass? I mean, that's putting a lot of pressure on the defense. So if I have the talent and personnel to play like that, without a doubt, I'm going to consider it.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, couldn't agree more with all that. You know, it's just, I'm not, you know, it's just interesting to see what other people are doing and what's working, you know. And I, you know, I see myself as being a college head coach one day. You know, I got a lot more more left to accomplish on the playing side of things. But one day, you know, as when that day comes, I'll be a college coach one day, and I believe I'll be a head coach one day. And you know, you just as you go along as a player, you know, as the way I've always looked at it is, I've always wanted to be a college coach, and I stash little things in my bag, you know, just see. You know, sometimes writing actual notes down, but other times just you know, making mental notes of what works and what doesn't, and how what are some, you know, different, certainly, you know, like different ways of looking at things. So, you know, we touched on a whole bunch of stuff there, you know, obviously a lot related to Oakland, but a lot, you know, well beyond Oakland too. So it's been great having my guy AV Alex Varlan on the show. The way I'm gonna stick with tradition, stick with routine, you know, like all great shooters have, you know, have a great routine. I'm gonna talk about as I mentioned earlier, you know, I took 257 three-pointers. I took 0 2-pointers my senior year of college. So we're gonna end it, wrap things up with a top three. This week's top three is we're gonna say who are the top three best second round picks. And I'm gonna say one. AV's gonna say one. We'll go back and forth. So we might even have some of the same on the list. So I'll let you kick it off with your number one and go for it, AV.
All right, time is Manu Ginobili. He's a guy who's won four NBA titles. He's a multi-time All-Star, multi-time All-NBA third team. He's been an MVP in Europe, an MVP in national competition with Argentina, and he's still at the age of 39 playing at a high level for the Spurs this year.
Damn it. That was exactly who was my number one. I
Great
didn't
minds think alike.
exactly. I didn't have a particular order, but he was one of mine. We might have the exact same three, but and you know, Manu's a guy, you know, I feel like everyone always on the Spurs, you know, never gets quite the respect that they deserve, or they don't even care about, you know, the respect that they deserve. They just want to win. And I think that being on the Spurs is, you know, for individual accolades, maybe not the best thing, but if you want to be a part of a culture, part of a team, part of a group of guys that wins, that doesn't care who gets the credit, you know, that's a special organization. And I think a lot of teams can learn a lot from them at any level. You know, I even remember my first year at Oakland, Coach Campy shared with us a video about the Spurs and just how they do things and how unselfishly they play, and being willing to go from a good shot to a great shot. And you know, Manu, his best statistical year I think came in 07 08 when he averaged almost 20 points, 19.5 points, and almost 5 assists and almost 5 rebounds while shooting over 40 from the three and 86 from the line. I mean, that's just while coming off the bench the majority of the time. So that's just you know, really special stuff from him. But he's a guy who was only, you know, only an All-Star twice, and those came when he was age 27 and age 33. You know what I mean? So obviously the guy has been playing at a high level for a very, very long time. And he, like you said, he's still kicking. He's still kicking, and we'll see how much he has left in the tank. But you know, it's impressive to watch, and definitely crazy to think that no one in the first round would have given him a shot. Who you got for number two?
Number two, I've got Marc Gasol.
Ooh.
Two-time NBA All-Star. He's been Defensive Player of the Year, All-NBA first and second team. He's been the MVP of the second best league in the world, the ACB in Spain. And that doesn't even touch on his passing abilities, that he's maybe one of the best all time at his position at.
Yeah, Marc Gasol. I mean, what can you say? The guy shoots now. His skill level, he's taken out. He's shooting threes. You know, he's hitting clutch threes for the Memphis Grizzlies, and I mean, paired with Zach Randolph, you know, a lethal high-low and able to spray the ball out to shooters, and got this array of moves that, you know, you really never see. Guys, 7 foot 1, doing, I don't even know how to describe some of the moves he makes. You know, funky hook shots, 1 foot runners, all sorts of moves, and just like you said, it, you know, a dominant player. He wasn't on my list, so my number two that I'm gonna go to is a guy who his peak didn't last too long necessarily, but at his peak, this guy was pretty damn good. And, you know, he's definitely got some personality to him. He's cut from a different sort of cloth, but this guy is Gilbert Arenas, Hibachi, you know, a guy who could heat up with the best of them, really. Peaked out averaging 29.3 points in 05-06 at, you know, put up big time numbers that year, averaged 28 the following year. Only a 3-time All-Star. I think his career was derailed due to injuries, but I mean, this dude could go get buckets. This dude, and he had the swagger to boot. You know, he could. I remember a shot when he buried one from the top of the key against the Utah Jazz. The dude, the game was, I think they were down 2 or maybe it was tied, I'm not sure, but this dude let it fly, and as the ball was traveling to the rim, turned around and put his hands up, knowing it went in, and he ended up banking it in and hit the game winner. So, I mean, that's ultimate confidence. And when you play like that, I mean, when you play with ultimate confidence, what can anyone say to you? What can anyone do? And to think that no one in the first round wanted to take a guy like that is definitely a shame. But let's go to your number 3.
My number 3, and I thought about it as well, but I went with this guy because he's one of those players who people look back on and say he helped evolve the NBA in a certain respect, and that's Draymond Green. Mm-hmm. Second round pick out of Michigan State. He's already won an NBA championship, been an All-Star, All-NBA second team, 2-time All-Defensive first team, and potentially Defensive Player of the Year this year. But the reason I put him on there is because of how he plays with his size. You know, he's a 6'7", 6'8" big man who can play make, score from the perimeter, but just really that he makes guys better. He can catch it off a mid roll and be able to kick it out to Steph and Clay and help make those guys better. So that's why I have him on the list.
Yeah, that's a great choice. There's really no going wrong with some of these guys. You know, Draymond, obviously what he does is helps everyone on that team, and, you know, creates a lot of different things, and he was a part of last year, you know, the best regular season team of all time. So his impact, you know, you can't really understate his impact. The next guy I'm going to go to, similar fashion to Gilbert Arenas, career didn't last as long as it really should have and got derailed. But I also think this guy played in, I think he played about 5 to 10 years too early, because I think with this whole 3-point revolution, he would have been thriving in today's game. And that's Michael Redd, a guy who peaked out at averaging almost 27 one year. Only a 1-time All-Star, but did average 27 and didn't make the All-Star game. I don't know what happened that year, but something had to happen that year. But he could shoot your eyes out, you know, versatile scorer, extremely aggressive, just a guy who, you know, breathed buckets when he played. But I just envision him playing in, you know, a system like Houston or Golden State nowadays, and just being one of the league leaders in 3-point makes and just those sorts of things. So that wraps up our top threes, and, you know, a lot of different players, you know, in the second round who we could have chosen, and, you know, there's only the top 3. So appreciate you sharing that with us, with everyone, actually, AV. And that just about wraps up the third edition of Shooting the Breeze, hosted by me, Max Hooper. AV, really appreciate you joining us and sitting down and talking some hoops.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Max. My pleasure.
Absolutely. All the best, and we'll hopefully have you back on the show, you know, one day when you're a head coach.
Anytime.
Let's plan on it. Take care.